So I want to welcome everybody. And this, of course, is an opportunity to reflect and contemplate experience here and now. Life is like this, is the name of it. And we can say life is like this in a, you know, in a way of just kind of as a put down. And when life gets difficult and we, you know, we find it everything going wrong, then we can bitterly, cynically say life is like this. Or, and that's not what the is meant by this title. Or life is like this is a way of reflecting. You know, what is it to be a conscious human being on a planet. So then with that in mind, then we began to just notice the, instead of somebody telling us exactly how we should be or how you should see life, you began to open and observe yourself what it is like in terms of having a physical body, in terms of aging process, of in terms of pleasure and pain, in terms of sickness and health, and then the experiences that we share through a lifetime of loss and frustration, exasperation, irritation, disappointment, as well as the highs of success, peak moments where everything is just the way we want it. But inevitably, most of us live through our peak moments and we get old. And old age is not a peak moment. It's you say, die young and have a beautiful corpse. That used to disturb me about, you know, going to heaven. If you die when you're 100 years old, do you take a 100-year-old body with you? Or do you have to live forever in an ancient body? But these are, that's not reflecting on the way life is, that's speculating. But in terms of noticing life, we're using this reflective awareness, observing direct experience right now, what it is to breathe or just to feel whatever you're feeling, either physically or mentally, emotionally. It's like this. So that puts us in a different position than when we're just caught up in the momentum of habit of trying to get what we want, trying to make life something that we think it should be, or trying to get rid of all the obstructions, difficulties, and problems just through resistance and denial and negative reactivity. And that in the example of the Buddha himself, and that he was a when you just what we have of his life is written in the scriptures, you know, it was a reflective life. Just the aging, the Buddha, the historical Buddha, Gautama Buddha, after his enlightenment, proceeded to age and suffer from physical problems, and then the death, the physical death. And so this puts us, this is an example. We think of, we'd like maybe have a Buddha that didn't die. Have a Buddha that never, once he was enlightened, he never got old. And he never had any sickness or ill health whatsoever, because enlightenment solves everything. So once you're enlightened, then you'll never have pain, never get hungry, never have arthritis, never have cancer. And you'll stay young and attractive, and never die is a kind of that's maybe an ideal that one might have of what you'd like. But the example of the Lord Buddha was one himself. He himself was an example of a human life. We can easily apotheosize the Buddha into some kind of special human being, or highly developed celestial being, or some god of some sort, to where then we can kind of admire from a distance and pray, but we can't relate his experience of life with anything that we're experiencing, because he's so special. He's not human. He doesn't have the same difficulties as we have as human beings. But in Buddhism, this isn't what is taught. Taught that the Buddha was born, grew up, experienced the pleasures of life. Life also has many pleasures and much beauty to it, and then enlightened. And after enlightenment, the physical body aged, just like anyone else's, and suffered from various, in the scriptures, from headaches or backaches and the usual problems of age until death. Well, this is very significant, because then I can relate my own life to even the what we have of the scriptural biography of the Lord Buddha, because it makes sense. It's something that is common to human beings, a common humanity which we share as human beings, rather than if we were some human beings were better than others, or the kind of race theories and Aryan race theory and things like that. These are not based on how things are. These are based on ideas. Like all these, like racism and all that, is an idea. It's not the truth of the way it is. When we're opening to the truth of the way it is, we're noticing what's the common factor in a human lifetime. And what is common, irregardless of gender, whether you're male or female, whatever race or ethnic background, whatever culture, religion, whatever age, or whether, and even the common factors of old age, sickness, and death in terms of are common to even all the animal realm. All sentient creatures have this cycle of birth to death. So in reflecting on life is like this, then we begin to open to life, to learn from it, rather than to constantly struggle against it, try to control it. How many of you try to control everything because of fear and wanting to make things into the way you think they should be, or endlessly caught up in self-protection and anxiety about the future, or guilt about the past? And that we suffer a lot of feelings of remorse or guilt about things we remember that weren't very good actions in the past, and those can haunt us until we die. Or we can endlessly be caught up in anxiety and fear and dread about the future. And the moment that we're actually experiencing life, we don't notice the here and now, isn't it? It's now that we're experiencing life. And that's the only time we ever experience life, is now. The future is, you know, whenever the future comes, it's always now. And so It's in terms of direct experience. You know, the future is the unknown. So we can speculate and guess, anticipate all kinds of things about what might happen. And the past, that's only a memory. Some people even lose their memory as they get older. They can't remember who they are. Some people. So I mean, it's so memory itself is something that you can't depend on as a, or to believe in, or to be obsess your consciousness with guilt, remorse, failures, mistakes you've made in the past. So this brings us always into this present moment, and that's where we are all the time. Like, for example, I've been speaking in the conventional way. I've lived in the UK now for nearly 24 years. So I have a lot of memories. But yet, in terms of experience, because of the practice of meditation, it almost seems like a timeless experience. Like 24 years, in terms of my conditioned mind, seems like a long time. I've been a monk 34 years. So that seems like a long time, especially if you aren't 34 yet, isn't it? As you get older, it doesn't seem so. But in terms of perceptions, like perceptions of time, I would say, I mean, I remember you, when I was in the Navy, that was 4 years in the Navy, the longest 4 years of my life. It was longer than 24 years in England. because it was something I was always, I mean, I was young, and 4 years at that age, when you're 19 years old, 4 years seems like an awful long time. But when you're this age, my age, 4 years doesn't seem very long, actually. But we have to deal with a perception. Like if we think of 20 years, I'll probably be dead in 20 years. 20 years, the future. That still seems like I've got plenty of time left, actually. But when I look back 20 years, it seems like 5 years. I mean, this is reflecting on the way it is in terms of my own experience of time, of past and future. So we have this ability to perceive time, to create perceptions of time, and these, like 20 years from now is a perception I'm creating right now. And 20 years from now, and that in terms of the cultural conditioning or cultural attitudes towards time that I have, seems like, you know, fairly long time. Could even live 30 more years, which isn't, it's too depressing. But anyway, if I think about it, it's depressing, isn't it? 20 years ago, like people now, the monks, most of the monks I live with, talk about the 60s as if they were the ancient history. And that's when I became a monk, was in the 60s. So this is just pointing out at this reference point of now, we know, what is past, what is future in terms of experience right now, not in terms of some definition that you get from your cultural conditioning, but in terms of how it seems emotionally to you right now, you know, like 20 years from now or 20 years ago. And so this is the way life is. The time is basically, you know, what we determined on, even though we see it in terms of clocks and revolutions around the sun and so forth, that actually it's much more subjective than that. That's a scientific perception of it. But in terms of experience, time goes by slowly, or goes by very slow or very fast, according to how interested or how bored we are, how happy or how miserable we might be. Like 4 years in the Navy, I wasn't happy. You know, wanted to get out. From the day I entered the gate of the naval base, I wanted to leave. So, I mean, that was, you know, just starting off at the beginning of a four-year hitch, as they say, four-year hitch in the Navy, and then counting down the days, you know. I remember the last year I had one of these desk calendars with a page for each day of the year, and I had it all counted down to the last day. But it did give me a peak moment when I left. I was discharged in the Treasure Island Naval Base near San Francisco. And so I remember walking out the gate. It was just wonderful to know I never would have to go back in that gate. And that's a peak moment of where somehow the 4 years of putting in time, counting time and longing to get out, led to a kind of peak moment of great relief. But then immediately, peak moment didn't last very long. You can't hold it and sustain it. So you get back into the way you think and react to life, even whether you're in the military or in lay life or monastic life. If you don't reflect on the way it is, don't notice, then we operate from various biases and prejudices and distortions, illusions that we have about ourselves, about the world that we live in. So then this Buddhist attitude of awakened awareness, the wake-up religion, wake-up teaching, which is, it says, wake up and notice how things are. Don't just let people tell you how they should be, or continually complain about what's wrong with the way it is, because that's depressing, isn't it? To just endlessly moan about the injustices or the faults and inadequacies of oneself, the people you're living with, the society you're in. Because things are like this. Life isn't a peak moment. It's not static. You'll never get this realm into a perfect peak moment and sustain it. Because that's not the way it is. Life isn't like that. Life is like this. It's consciousness. We're experiencing consciousness now. So consciousness means that we have a physical body that's very sensitive. We have eyes and ears and nose and tongue, physical body. We have a brain, we have memory. We have language. We have we have retentive memory, so we can remember all kinds of things from our past. And so this is a very sensitive state we're in. You know, this realm is called the sense realm, because that means it's sensitive. It's like this. Being sensitive is like this. It means you have to feel all the time. Something's either, you know, something's always impinging on you in some way or affecting you, whether it's externally from outside or your own karma. Karmic tendencies, the way you think and what the kind of memories that you hold on to, or the prejudices or biases or opinions and views or emotional habits that you have. These are always being triggered off and being set into motion due to various conditions when they arise. So when and if we don't understand this, then we do feel generally frustrated. We tend to want to control everything because we don't know what to do if everything got out of control. You know, that's one of the great fears, isn't it, of many human beings is, what will I do if I lose control? And then we imagine the worst possible things of making a fool of ourselves, doing something stupid, humiliation, all kinds of possibilities. If we lose control, we might go crazy. And this idea of going crazy is a frightening one, isn't it? Where we're no longer considered a compos mentis. We're always tainted by this perception. He's a bit, you know, off. Or to have some label attached to you, you know, that you're to even prove the medically approved diagnosis about you, and then your identity is reinforced with all these perceptions, and the fear of losing control. So in with the awakeness, when we're not awake, then we're frightened, because life is very frightening from the way we tend to perceive ourselves living in this world. Because it is a rather frightening experience in a personal way. To be kind of brought forth as a sensitive form, conscious form, in such a vast and mysterious universe. You know, it's daunting when you start looking out at night at the sky and in the clear night. It's so mysterious and so kind of vast, and you feel so helpless, like a nothing, like a little termite or even less than a termite in this vast universe. And because you know, when you're with your friend in a nicely decorated room, you can feel there's a level of control and familiarity there, that everything's contained with walls and familiar objects and friendly people. But when those change, isn't it? Then it brings up what we won't be able to control it. We'll lose control. What'll we do if we allow, we're afraid of foreigners or aliens. There's one, I remember, movie review I read was commenting on why are all these sci-fi films about outer space, all the aliens are kind of horrendous, voracious monsters. Why couldn't there be some nice aliens? Really beautiful, really lovely ones that come down to love us and make us happy. Why is it always some grotesque, monstrous, kind of reptilian-type creature? Because if you're going to imagine, you know, both, really. But but because of the fear, isn't it, we tend to see alien, anything alien, foreign, as what you don't know. I don't know about them. You don't know what they'll do. You don't know what they think, on and on like that. So then we want to just keep them away from us, because if we allow them, then we lose control. We don't have a sense of being unsafe. So awakened awareness is opening to the universe, to all of it, not to just a little nice little room that we have that we can protect and feel safe in, but towards everything, towards heaven and hell, towards all alien creatures, whether they're reptilian monsters or lovely angelic forms or whatever. Our relationship to them then is openness and recognition. They're like this. We begin to see there's a wisdom faculty we begin to rely on when we awaken to life. that we don't notice when we're trying to control it and bend it to our desires or protect ourselves endlessly from any possible danger. When we talk about wisdom in Buddhism, this panya, it's called panya, is the word. It doesn't mean like knowing a lot about what wise sages have said. It's an intuitive wisdom. It's natural to us. It's not something that you acquire through study or anything. It's not like you lack it, or anybody here in this room lacks wisdom or doesn't have any. It's just we may not use it very much. We don't appreciate it. We don't know how to develop wisdom in our lives, because the society we live in isn't particularly wise, is it? It's not a society that encourages wise reflection on anything. So that, you know, in the modern world, it's very much a controlling situation. You can see how with the fuel strike and all that, there is not any real, you know, not many people were interested in really trying to understand the problem, you know, in terms of what it really is, what it means, but in terms of political perspective, in terms of personal inconvenience, in terms of them against us, in terms of my authority and you, and on like this. So it's a society that is very much, you know, lock up the criminals, mentally ill, put them in institutions, and chuck out the foreigners, and Britain's pretty good actually, but there is this mentality, isn't it? Because it is based on fear of the unknown, of this and a very constricted identity with what I am, what I feel I am, what I accept. Then I can only accept that much, and if it expands beyond that, then it's unbearable. I can't take it. I can't accommodate anything more. But with awakened awareness, I found in my own experience, living as a Buddhist monk, just the ability to adapt through mindfulness. For example, living in Thailand for 10 years, just learning to adapt, to open to the society I was in, rather than just try to, you know, protect myself or find a little niche just for me that I could, you know, live my own life. In fact, with a teacher like Ajahn Chah, he was very much pushing me always into the middle of experience of life as a monk, and right into the middle of monastic life. He would never let me kind of, even though the tendency sometimes wanting to move out on, you know, to move out and kind of remain the special foreign monk and keep myself kind of in a special position, he's always bringing me back into the middle of it. Which of course was challenging a lot of doubt and fear and frustration, because when you live in a country whose language and culture you haven't quite tuned into yet, you know, you really feel very you can have a lot of paranoia and anxiety around it, frustration. But then Nungpa Cha was very good at pointing out how life is like this. And I remember one time, and this was years ago, in 1966, when I lived in Nong Khai, before Laos went communist, I lived right across the river from Laos in Nong Khai. So there's a lot in those days. Thailand and Laos was, you know, you could go back and forth without any passport, any problems. Just go across the river, and you were there. And it was very much like northeast Thailand is. So So I remember the conflicts that were already operating there. There were all these different like CIA agents and then the China and Vietnam and so forth. So many, in fact, Vientiane in those days was considered a kind of like an international spy center. So it was kind of interesting place to be around. You know, there's a red Chinese embassy, there's an American embassy, and that was seldom possible in those days, to have those two embassies in the same city. But anyway, at one time, out of just total, you know, surprisingly, that one of the southern towns of Laos, that an Air Force general was somehow got annoyed with the general up in Vientiane, and flew up and bombed the airfield. And it was his. And so I remember the monks telling me about this, and I was thinking, that's really stupid, you know. They shouldn't be doing things like that. And I was very indignant because I've been brought up to get indignant about such kind of actions. And then the monk said, but that's the way life is, isn't it? And my reaction was, well, I mean, aren't you, no, don't you, doesn't that upset you? Or doesn't that make you angry? We can't allow this. Getting back into my graduate student Berkeley mode, you know, of protest. Shaking the fist and blaming, the monk said, "Isn't that the way life is?" And anyway, it was such a to me. It was such a. I was so surprised at his response, because he was quite a very intelligent man, actually. So it wasn't like, you know, somebody that, you know, that you didn't respect. I had a lot of respect for this monk. So I started, you know, I left an imprint in my mind. Life is like this, and you know, of this endless battle, controlling power, wanting control, this envy and jealousy, and the way that we compete and challenge each other, in whether it's on a personal level or political or sports, whatnot. It's this is part of our human experience. Being from an American background, the thing that I found was that you tend to think that the way you think is the way everybody else does. And when you live in countries, other countries, you realize they don't think like that. Or not many do. And so so this is another thing, by noticing the way it is, then, you know, I used to think that they should think like I do. But if I awaken, and right now I begin to see, that's a creation of my mind. You should, what I feel, what I, my opinion, my values, my principles, should be yours also. And when I look at that as experience in the present, I see it as a kind of demand I make on life, that it is always leading me to be disappointed or disillusioned and unaccepting and not open to the variety of conditioned phenomena that I experience. That it, I can't, you know, it's when you're caught in that mode all the time, when you see you should think like your principles, your views should be like mine, then that's asking the impossible from others, and then it always leads to a sense of frustration and disappointment, betrayal. I found in friendships oftentimes, you form kind of personal friendships with people, and then when they don't do something that you think they should, or don't respond in the way that you feel a friend should, then the word betrayal comes up in the mind. You've betrayed me. Or I would tend to say, I don't trust you anymore. It's a kind of way of thinking, you've totally disappointed me, and I can no longer trust or respect you because you haven't lived up to what my expectations are, and you failed me in some way. You've let me down. When I look at that as experience, you know, in terms of when I feel like that, I have that emotion, and I hold to that emotion, but I start looking at it now with awakened awareness. You know, it's an unpleasant way to be. You know, the thing itself holds the, you know, the emotional quality is very distressing and unpleasant to have this sense of demand on others not to betray me or that my respect is so important that people should obey me or never disappoint me, never betray me, never let me down. Then you're getting it back to a real sense of you know, self-centeredness. You know, me, and I want the world to be what I want it to be so that I will, then I'll feel safe, I'll feel loved, I'll feel accepted, I'll feel okay about everything. My fears will go away. I'll have friends that will never let me down, never betray me, that I can trust forever and live in a society that will always be fair and just and democratic and understand all my needs and take care of me till I die. So this is not the way life is it? But we can open to that feeling of this self-centered concern, this identity with yourself as a person that is so strong, so fixed, so unchallenged, that you make all your judgments from that personal experience of life. So it's interesting with the meditation now, interest in Buddhist meditation, how that this kind of consciousness now is being explored in a way that it never has been. It's quite an interesting subject. Interesting subject to talk about in psychology, psychiatry, because consciousness is the thing that we're experiencing all the time. You know, whenever we're away, you know, when we're asleep, we have a sleep consciousness. But other than that, those moments, we are experiencing consciousness right now. So just notice the consciousness, what is it in terms of experience right now? Now, you might want me to define it in terms of what the authorities say or the Abhidhamma or the Buddhist text. But with awareness, we're just noticing that consciousness has always this sense of subject-object. In that, like right now, I'm here, the physical body, this entity's here, and you're an object in my consciousness. Well, that's different than, say, the conventional way of looking at it, which is that I'm sitting here and you're sitting there and you're listening to me and we're talking on a conventional level of a cultural, common cultural attitudes of the seemingness or the accepted way we interpret experience. But when we look at it in terms of experience now, then you're actually in my mind. Because I see you, I can see my hands and my knees. I can't see my face. And I can't see my eyes. So this is consciousness. Consciousness is this point here. Consciousness you can also see as light. Like, it's interesting to observe, like the yesterday morning, I woke up early and I went outside in the garden and there was a crescent moon and a very clear, beautiful, balmy, pleasant night. with the stars twinkling. And it's so beautiful and so pleasant, you know, it's contemplating this as experience, how this point of light, this light here, and that light way out in space, like a star, or the refracted light that the moon has, or the sun, and light is this, that consciousness is light. So when we begin to recognize our own gift of consciousness, that this is with us, then we begin to rest in this light, rather than always looking for light as some external experience. If you don't know this, then you tend to, then one, we think, oh, it's dark. Turn on the light. And we become frightened of the dark, because we don't know, you know, what's out there, because our attention tends to project outside ourselves a lot into what we can imagine. But in terms of direct experience, in the dark, in a dark room, in a black room, the light's still on, you're conscious. And learn to recognize that, to reflect on that. Consciousness is like this. So it's a knowing, isn't it? It's a way of knowing experience. It's not, consciousness isn't cultural. It's not personal. It's not racial, or it's not, no gender to it, not male or female, young or old. It's light, like the sun. Light is, doesn't, can't say it doesn't belong. It's my light, and you can't have it. Well, I put a, you know, they put a sign, this is my sun, keep away. This would be a sign of, you know, real delusion. But if you recognize this light of being conscious, and then awaken, use conscious, because consciousness functions, but we can also create endless clouds or delusions into the conscious experience. So this is what happens when we, like through our experience of life, when we get conditioned, merely conditioned through cultural conditioning or social conditioning, then it's like we have this consciousness, we're conscious, but it's completely kind of distorted and clouded over and influenced by our emotional habits or our views and opinions, our feelings. The way we look at our own body, isn't it? We can, the identity we hold, personal identity with the physical body that's here. We can be quite miserable just because somebody doesn't like the way we look. Anyway, somebody insults, says, you know, you're an ugly old guy. Skinhead. Why are you wearing those sheets? Say that. I don't mind Hare Krishna, though. That's okay. But anyway, this identity, you know, with appearance, that distorts things so that we become self-conscious and obsessed with appearance and with how we look and how we want others to see us. And those are conditions we create into consciousness. So with awareness, we're learning to see that. We see the things that we create, we don't have to hold to. We don't have to, they become habits, and and habits are something that just, you are habituated to. Habits are habitual. A habit, you know, what you're used to, even if it's a bad habit, you're used to it. That's why it's hard to stop smoking and things like this. You know, it says, it's hazardous to your health in big letters, but it's easier to smoke than not to, because of it's a habit, you're habituated to it. So with awakenedness, you're not trying to just stop smoking because out of fear, but with just repress all your habits and try to kind of take on a more, you know, what you think are better habits by repressing the old ones. That doesn't work. It's learning to understand life is like this, which is not a justification. You know, it's not it can be another way of just justifying mediocrity and misery. Life is like this. Or we begin to open to life in terms of what it really is, in terms of beginning to recognize, to trust in awareness, in allowing, in recognizing the gift of consciousness that we're experiencing, and learning to that this consciousness is something that we're not helpless victims of our conditioning. We have a way of liberating ourselves from even bad habits or bad conditioning and attachment. So this is what the Lord Buddha was pointing to. This was his teaching about waking up and liberating the individual human conscious entity, liberating oneself from the delusions that we create. I notice in over the years of this kind of practice it becomes clearer and clearer as you keep trusting in this reflectiveness, in this awareness. Because there's a wisdom that's natural to us. And the Buddhist teachings, actually, as we find them, say, in the Pali Canon or the scripture, if you just memorize those teachings, it doesn't mean you're any wiser for it. You know, but it means that those teachings are helping you to develop wisdom through waking up. Because the Buddhists, like the Four Noble Truths, all these teachings are pointing to experience now. They're not doctrines in themselves that you operate from. They're not statements that you attach to and then logically deduct from those positions. Like when the Buddha says there is suffering, it is not saying you have to accept there is suffering and attach to that as some kind of Buddhist doctrine. He's pointing to there is suffering. What is it? What is suffering? As experienced now. And so then, because of that, then I start looking here, you know, the suffering of being attached to my own views and opinions, of self-consciousness, feeling betrayed by friends, or feeling disappointed or disillusioned with this or that. And the feeling of identity with the identity I have with this physical form. It's never good enough, is it? Never was. Even when I was young, I always could think I could look better than I did. There was no gratitude or appreciation for the good features I did have. It was always, it could be better. So this was always this sense of vanity and criticism, and so it would take the joy out of one's life. Would, even though, say, life has not been a particularly, I've not had a very miserable life, actually. I've been quite fortunate. But I've created a lot of misery into my consciousness through not understanding, not reflecting, not awakening to life. then recognize it, just contemplating this yesterday morning, standing out in the garden and looking up at the sky and this light, you know, seeing this consciousness as light can recognize light, isn't it? Even though it's way off in the expanse of the dark night and sees the stars. And this light then is consciousness. It's something that's with us all the time. It's not something that can let us down if we open to it, if we awaken. But of course, what comes up in consciousness can be anything, isn't it? Your habits, your anger, resentments, jealousies, fears, hatreds, greed in all its forms, doubt and worry, all these things arise into consciousness. So if you don't know the difference, then you're caught into these mental states that you create endlessly. So because like if you see life in a certain way, or you have certain character tendencies, or you've had a very difficult background, or a lot of pain and rejection or alienation in your life, then we form perceptions and memories and attitudes that come up into consciousness. So then we're caught in these all the time if we don't know the difference between consciousness and the mental conditions we create. So therefore, it's like awakened awareness puts us in the state of a continuity of experience. Like emotional experience is changing all the time. You can't, when you really look at your emotional habits, you can go up and down like a yo-yo sometimes. I mean, you can just, somebody, you know, you feel elated one moment and totally suicidal the next. Because emotions are like that, they change. And then other emotions that, like dullness or worry, kind of worried states of mind, and these seem to hang around us. But actually, when you start observing them for what they are, as experienced now, you see their changingness. They have no... There's no core to it, nothing that holds it. The thing that's holding you is sati and panya, or mindfulness and wisdom. So that is aware, that's transcending the mental condition, the physical body, the emotional habit, the character tendencies, in Buddhist terms, the vipaka kamma. Now, in vipaka kamma is a very useful perception, actually, for those of you who don't know what it is. It's karma. Of course, the law of karma is a cause and effect. If you do good, you get a good result. You do bad, you get a bad result. Then vipaka is a resultant karma that arises. Now, karma arises according to conditions. It has no independence. It isn't just kind of latently lying around inside you or collecting in some place like in a money in a bank or something. When the conditions arise, when the conditions are there, then this karma arises in your consciousness. So noticing this, that the vipaka kamma is we experience, like the Lord Buddha in the scriptures experienced his vipaka kamma. After he was enlightened, he didn't get out of it. You know, so when people would, when you read the scripture, then the Buddha had to put up with some pretty miserable things after his enlightenment. His cousin tried to kill him, and it was all kinds of nasty things, blamed for things, rumors spread, stubborn and recalcitrant bhikkhus and bhikkhunis and jealousies and whatnot. And the Buddha would see this as vipaka kamma, you know. So his relationship to his feeling and his experience in the present was of acceptance and awareness and wisdom rather than of judgment or rejection or blame. So, you know, whatever way you're feeling now, right now, is the vipaka. You know, the conditions that are present now, they come together, so this is the way you're feeling. And so this is the present, and this is what, because the now is where we experience life. So vipaka is what we're always feeling now, you know, whether, and that can change according to whether that you're being praised or blamed or loved or hated or you're a winner or a loser, success or a failure, or nothing much happening at all. The vipaka kamma is like this, the way life is. Then as we recognize that, then we don't create karma with the vipaka kamma. See, the law of karma is you make karma if you attach or reject it, the two extremes, where, you know, the vipaka kamma that arises in the present is like this, and then you say, you wallow in it. Or then, oh, I mustn't think like that. Oh no, that's bad thought. I must, can't do that, reject that. That's karma also. So you're creating, you're constantly reinforcing your karmic, your habitual patterns all the time through this heedlessness, not understanding. But in awakened awareness, then the vipaka kamma arises, you're aware of it. It's like this. But this ability to embrace it, to let it be the way it is. You're not judging it, you're not blaming anybody, you're just accepting it, whatever it is, good or bad, neutral. And then it ceases, so you can actually, you observe. If you learn to trust in awareness, you are aware of it, the presence and the absence of something. So it arises, it ceases. And that which is aware, it's not a person, it's not Ajahn Sumedho or any person. It's through consciousness that we are aware. And so then we're seeing things through wisdom. We're informing our conscious experience through wisdom rather than through ignorance. So this is the thrust of the Buddha's teaching, to keep developing this, because it does, you know, over, you might understand it theoretically, but to keep practicing it does take a determination and a willing to really, you know, to open to life and to the things that we're frightened of. You know, really be more kind of brave and open to fear and to the things you most dread. And as you change your attitude towards them, then you can resolve, let go of those conditions, and not create more, reinforce those habits through just repeating the same thing over and over again. So life is like this, and tea time in England, life is like this, tea time. So in, say, 20 minutes from now, anyone who's interested, we can have a discussion on this subject.